Welcome to the PRI Review, brought to you by the Population Research Institute. I'm your host, Christopher Mannion. When the Communist Party of China implemented a comprehensive two-child policy in 2016, outside observers assumed that it would be voluntary, and why should they not? To all appearances, this was a dramatic relaxation, a doubling, no less, of the restrictive one-child policy. But appearances can be deceiving, especially where China is concerned. Instead of enjoying a new dawn of reproductive freedom, Chinese couples are actually being herded into something resembling reproductive servitude. I say this because what the party has actually decided to do, according to internal party documents, is comprehensive implementation of a policy of each couple giving birth to two children. End quote. In other words, after decades of ordering couples to have no more than one child, the party has now done a complete about-face and is instructing them that they should have no less than two. The above quote comes from a directive issued by the party authorities in Yicheng, a central Chinese city of some 4 million people. Such provincial and local party directives, it should be noted, always hew closely to the official party line. In fact, it is safe to assume that the Yicheng directive, minor edits aside, simply parrots the central committee directive, still secret, that first laid out the new policy. So what does the Yicheng Directive on implementing the new comprehensive two-child policy, so titled, which is addressed to all Communist Party members and government organizations in the municipality, actually say? It begins by affirming that the comprehensive two-child policy, and I quote, is an important initiative undertaken by the Party Central Committee that affects the reproduction of the Chinese race from one generation to the next, as well as the health and happiness of future generations. The reference to the Central Committee, the most powerful political body in the country, makes it clear that what follows is an order, not a suggestion. Like the imperial edicts once issued by China's emperors, it is simply to be obeyed, not questioned. The Yicheng authorities, having established that the future of the Chinese race is at stake, go on to lament the current birth dearth. Our city's birth rate is beyond low, with women not even averaging one child each. If this situation continues, it will pose dangerous risks and do enormous harm to our city's economic development, as well as threaten the family happiness of the masses. Since couples in Yicheng are voluntarily averaging less than one child, they obviously don't feel that being parents of an only child in any way threatens their family happiness. Local and national party officials, however, feel differently. Like their national counterparts, they obviously view the unwillingness of those under their control to reproduce as a direct threat to their power, as the next sentence of the directive makes clear. The direct consequence of this, the low birth rate, is the risk of more one-child families, the aging of the population, shortages in the workforce, and lagging behind in urbanization. This will, in turn, affect labor productivity and the overall economic competitiveness of our city. To implement the comprehensive two-child policy, the directive announces a whole raft of pronatal initiatives. For instance, public hospitals will deliver a second child for free, and maternity leave will be lengthened. The medical exams required before couples can marry and the eugenics exams required before they can conceive children will both be free. Obstetrical and pediatric health services will be increased, and child care and education facilities will be expanded. Infertility services, for those unable to conceive and bear children, and for women near the end of their reproductive lives, will be expanded. None of these initiatives are, as it turns out, unique to Yicheng. Similar initiatives have been announced by literally dozens of provincial and municipal jurisdictions throughout China, obviously in response to the same central government guidelines that Yicheng is following. Most observers think that such perks will scarcely be enough to convince all or even most of this generation of young Chinese singletons to marry and have children. The Yicheng authorities seem to agree because they put the burden of enforcing the policy directly on their fellow party members. Using language reminiscent of China's Maoist past, but still used in internal party documents today, the Yicheng Party Committee issues an order. All Communist Party members under its jurisdiction are to take the lead in responding to the Party Central Committee's call to have a second child. Older comrades, that is to say, those who are beyond their childbearing years, are instructed to educate and supervise their children in the new policy. In other words, parents are to ensure that their own grown child, most will have only one, goes on to give them and the country two grandchildren. Younger comrades, by which is meant those still able to have children, are given an even more difficult assignment. They are told that they must help implement the comprehensive two-child policy by leading by example. The Chinese phrase used in the text literally means, "Doing it starts with me." In other words, younger party members are being ordered to bear two children. Party members must also mobilize the masses, they are then told. Every comrade must become a propagandist, publicize the benefits of having two children and the risks associated with having only one. Strongly encourage the masses, especially women of childbearing age, to adopt the policy as their own. Guide the masses to be responsible and follow the new birth plan by having a second child. All manner of measures must be used to mobilize the masses and to actively implement the comprehensive two-child policy. By now, each and every one of China's 90 million Communist Party members knows what their comrades of Yicheng know, namely, that there is a new political campaign underway to raise the birth rate. Each and every party member has seen a local party directive similar to Yicheng's and has been told to mobilize the masses to have two children. They have been told to lead by example and to pressure their own children to comply. We in the West, long accustomed to China brutally restricting births under the one-child policy, have to understand that there is a new reality in China. An aging population, a shrinking workforce, and diminishing economic prospects have led Beijing to strikingly reverse course. The Chinese Party state has stopped forcing young women to have abortions. Under its new comprehensive two-child policy, it is now mandating that they give birth. This is PRI Review from pop.org. We'll be right back. Do you want to win pro-life legislative and political battles? For years, PRI has been helping pro-life leaders on the ground around the world to win legislative and political battles in order to protect the lives of the unborn. And now we're asking for your help so we can continue this vital work. Let me tell you more. In a number of countries around the world, there are still pro-life laws on the books. But the Planned Parenthood abortion liberales Malthusians are out there to get rid of those laws. Nearly 5 years ago, the Pontifical Council on the Family asked PRI to be the main organization to help the pro-life movements around the world to be more effective. In response to the Vatican's request, we created our Pro-Life Victory Seminars and our Pro-Life Strategy Guide. The seminars are grueling, demanding 12 to 14-hour intense working sessions. Only the most proven and successful leaders are invited to speak. Only the best and the most committed activists are invited to attend. To date, we have conducted 60 such sessions in 18 countries. We have trained more than 1,700 people who are serious about protecting the unborn in their respective countries. They have won some victories, but I'm not going to tell you about those because I don't want to put a target on the back of those leaders. I'm not going to tell you the names of their countries either because I don't want to make it even harder for them to do their work. But here's a hint. Most, though not all, have Spanish as their native tongue. It's no secret that south of our border, pro-abortionists are zeroing in on the existing pro-life laws in that part of the world. I cannot tell you the battle stories, although there are many, without endangering the victories of the leaders. I must ask you to take my word that some battles in some countries could not have been won without the training and support received from PRI. What kind of training am I talking about? Everywhere in the world, defenders of life need everything: strategic thinking skills, campaign skills, legislative skills, lobbying skills, to protect their pro-life laws and to stop pro-death initiatives. Around the world, we found that the biggest thing lacking is know-how. By that, I mean political sophistication. Here in America, we've been fighting pro-life battles for almost 50 years, and while we haven't won definitively, we have learned a lot about how to fight, as well as how not to fight. One of the most important tools of our pro-life victory training is the manual that the trainees get to take home with them, the Pro-Life Strategy Guide, the guide to winning pro-life battles. Think of it as a field guide to activism. The guide is a compendium of know-how. It is 200 pages of distilled experience and wisdom, with step-by-step instructions about how to advance our issue in a representative landscape. Here's a small sampling of the know-how delivered in these training sessions. How to raise money, how to lobby legislators, how to write powerful pro-life advertising, how to effectively appear on TV and radio, how to enlist volunteers, how to get out the vote, and how to successfully debate pro-abortionists. All this and much, much more is covered in the training program and reinforced in the training guide. The first edition came out in 2012, but we are all out of them now. They have all been put in the hands of able pro-life leaders. So today we have had it revised and updated by two of the best and most successful activists in the Spanish-speaking world. Today, the new PRI, Pro-Life Strategy Guide, the guide to winning pro-life battles, is ready to go to press. This is where you come in. Will you help us get it into the hands of the people who need it? It's in Spanish right now, and that's as it should be, because we distribute it throughout the Spanish-speaking world. The Vatican wants this field manual in every diocese in the world. Will you help me to fulfill that request? PRI has ordered 10,000 copies of the guide to be printed, enough for every student who will attend our training sessions for the next several years, along with all the actively pro-life bishops around the world. Just the printing alone will cost $50,000. The whole International Victory Training Program costs another $50,000, and that is in addition to the field guide. But right now, we want to get those guides printed. So I turn to you because I know you understand its value. The cost comes out to about $5 per book, which is not very much considering the impact it can have and the lives it can save. With your tax-deductible gift of $50, PRI can put this guide into the hands of 10 in-country pro-life leaders. With a gift of $100, we can make sure that 10 friendly bishops get a copy to guide their strategic thinking in the protection of life. No gift is too small. If you can only spare $5, please send it today. Unborn babies around the world will be safer because of your sacrifice today. Can we count on you to help PRI to continue to train and empower the pro-life movement around the world? On behalf of all those fighting to preserve pro-life laws around the world, thank you. republic if you can keep it. That's what Ben Franklin answered when he was walking out of the Constitutional Convention in 1787, and a woman asked him, "What have you done? What have you given us?" "A republic if you can keep it," he said. Well, every year, on September 17th, America celebrates Constitution Day, commemorating the signing of the Constitution in 1787. This year, Hillary Clinton used the occasion to complain that she would have won the presidency in 2016 had it not been for the Constitution. The Constitution apparently is undemocratic, and Mrs. Clinton champions democracy, which she calls our birthright as Americans. Of course, she ignores the Founding Fathers who detested democracy. They believe that our birthright is liberty. They knew their Aristotle. In his Politics, he carefully explains how democracy, the rule of the mob, leads to the rise of the tyrant. Some 750 years later, St. Augustine discerned a simple truth that inspired Western civilization for over 1,000 years. Aristotle sought man's highest good, and Augustine, in the light of Revelation, told us what that highest good is. We achieve our highest good when we enjoy the beatific vision in heaven. To attain that eternal goal, he explains, our goal in this life is virtue, and the highest virtue is caritas, love, a motion of the soul towards the enjoyment of God for his own sake, and the enjoyment of oneself and one's neighbor for the sake of God. Well, the government, any government, ultimately rules by force. Government certainly cannot love whatever form the regime takes. It can't make us love either. So it can't attain our highest goal for us no matter how hard it tries, no matter how much power it has. Augustine tells us that the earthly ruler can provide us with only a modicum of peace, justice, and order in which to work out our salvation. But while our salvation is eternal, those goals are temporal, and thus they are subordinate. Hence, government must be limited in order for man to flourish in the realm of freedom that government must protect but not invade. Augustine's notion of limited government was new to the ancient world, and it has been central to the history of Christendom. While the West flourished, every other civilization languished in tyranny. What made the West different? Christianity and its limits on power. The lust for power, Augustine explains, is the driving force of the city of man, whose ruler is Satan. That's why, since the French Revolution, those seeking unlimited power have unanimously recognized that they must destroy not only the limits on power, but the truth that demands those limits. They must destroy the Catholic faith. And in destroying those limits and the faith that informs them, they must also destroy the source of that faith, the church, the bulwark that is the tyrant's timeless obstacle to achieving unlimited power and keeping it. Once that destruction is achieved, the left can finally attain its goal. As O'Brien describes to Winston in Room 101, the torture chamber of Big Brother's Ministry of Truth, that goal is a boot stamping on a human face forever. Well, our Constitution was written to prevent tyrants, not to preserve them. The founders limit power in many ways. They were realists, not ideologues. They knew well the imperfection of fallen man and the attractions of the nefarious temptations to illegitimate power. So they introduced checks and balances to curb them. They included now familiar but at the time groundbreaking principles, separation of powers, the executive, the legislative, and the judicial, each with limited and defined powers, the division of powers, state versus federal, with the guarantee that the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. That is a verbatim reading of the 10th Amendment to the Bill of Rights. In James Madison's words, ambition must be made to counteract ambition. Well, one thing we know about Hillary Clinton is that she resents powerfully anything that counteracts her ambition. And right now she's convinced that the Constitution is her enemy because she wants to destroy the barriers to the mob rule that our founders strived to avoid, and her number is legion. Decades of content-free public schools and generations of lazy, ill-educated journalists, not to mention shallow politicians, constantly trumpet the notion that the United States is a democracy. Well, democracy is the horse that Mrs. Clinton is going to ride, and she isn't wasting any time. In order to erase the Constitution's barrier, the unfair barrier to the victory she should have had, she is blunt. I passionately believe it's time to abolish the Electoral College, she writes. Mrs. Clinton's apology tour never seems to end, but her passion for democracy is widely shared among the radical left. Consider, if the presidency could be won with a simple majority of votes cast across the country, candidates could campaign in a couple of dozen major cities. Now, all of them would be failing miserably, of course, governed by the left-wing Democrats. Chicago, Philadelphia, St. Louis, you need not look any further, and of course, all of California, as well as the 12 states where the majority of the voters live. The rest of the country, the 80% of America's counties that Trump won, would be left high and dry forever. We recall that the Electoral College was adopted in order specifically to convince smaller and less populated states to support the Constitution in the first place. It's a slam dunk that the required 38 states today would never support a constitutional amendment granting Hillary Clinton's passionate wish. Well, what about all the fuss about Kavanaugh? The Supreme Court amends the Constitution all the time, doesn't it? Doesn't that sound attractive to Hillary's passionate followers? Consider, Article 4 of the Constitution guarantees to the states a Republican form of government. But in 1962, the swaggering Warren Court declared that the Republican form of government of the United States Senate was unconstitutional when enacted in the states. The court thus required that state Senate districts be apportioned with equal populations in each. Now, if this principle were applied to the United States Senate, the states of North Dakota, Alaska, Vermont, and Wyoming would have to join forces in order to get just one Senate seat between them, out of 100. But no problem. A profound change that the states never would have approved as a constitutional amendment was imposed on them by a simple decision of the Supreme Court. Well, why not abolish the Electoral College by judicial fiat? All you need is 5 willing justices. Enter Judge Brett Kavanaugh. He believes in obeying the Constitution as written, not the Constitution he would have written had he been in Philadelphia 231 years ago. But there are 4 justices on the Supreme Court today who take a different view. With just one more justice of like mind, they could change the United States Constitution by a wave of the wand in the same fashion that the Warren Court changed the constitutions of every state in the Union. Their allies on the left are very well aware that their victories in the court, on abortion, on same-sex marriage, and countless other issues, could be reversed with the same ease that they were achieved by a mere majority of the justices of the Supreme Court. Let's face it, for the left, Hillary is expendable, but her nonstop whining accurately reflects the resentment and hatred of millions on the left for the reality that they never thought could come to pass. She lost. And now the left rages at the logical consequence of that fact. Donald Trump won, and he is nominating Supreme Court justices that they cannot abide. They want an activist Supreme Court that will overturn every section of the Constitution that limits their power. and that's why there might well be a string of anonymous Hillary diehards showing up every 10 days until Christmas, claiming that Brett Kavanaugh did something awful to them in grade school. This charade parade is all they have left. But bear in mind, their target is not only Kavanaugh. It is a warning. The same sully and ruin campaign will be directed at any nominee whom Trump dares to name to the court. Leftists will always do whatever they can get away with, and they always have. To paraphrase Lenin, whatever furthers the revolution is ethical. And there are 49 Democrats in the United States Senate who agree with him. So stay tuned. This is PRI Review from the Population Research Institute at pop.org. We'll be right back. What's the best way to celebrate Humani Vitae's 50th birthday? For most of us, the answer is close to home, and specifically in our own parishes. Here's why. 6 years ago, when Timothy Cardinal Dolan was president of the U.S. Bishops' Conference, he admitted that our bishops have had laryngitis on Blessed Pope Paul's beautiful encyclical. Laryngitis for 50 years! Unfortunately, that's still true for many bishops who are too tied up with the political agenda of their national bureaucracy in Washington. There, issues like global warming, socialized medicine, and federal contracts for the bishops' welfare agencies have dominated the agenda for years, crowding out pro-life efforts and leaving Humani Vitae an orphan. That doesn't mean that the lay faithful haven't been asking. We have. In fact, pleas to our shepherds have had some heartwarming results in recent months, with several bishops coming forward with strong public defenses of Humani Vitae. But the real work has to come from the grassroots, and that means the laity, because our busy bishops can't do it alone. They need our support, our encouragement, and our prayers. After all, the pro-life movement started at the grassroots, and its strength has stayed there. Bishops are often supportive of pro-life groups in their dioceses, but few are focused on them. Most chancery staffs spend much more time on immigration, refugees, fundraising, and other programs that receive federal funding. Pro-life efforts receive no federal funding, so pro-lifers have to fend for ourselves. While our bishops have countless distractions, our parish priests know us and we know them. They offer our most reliable source of support and encouragement when it comes to celebrating Humani Vitae's birthday party. And a wise pastor has a good suggestion on how to make it work. It boils down to this. Instead of telling your pastor, "Father, you ought to do something about this," tell him, "Father, a group of us would like to have a reading group in the parish to study Humani Vitae. We've got the texts, the commentaries, and all the materials. All we need is some space in the parish one night a week and an announcement in the bulletin to spread the word. Don't worry, we'll do all the work, but we'd love to have your support, and it would be great if you could join us whenever you can." And by the way, a further note from long pastoral experience, don't ask Father on the way out of Mass. Write him a note and ask him for a few minutes of his time at his convenience. There you'll have his full attention, and he can write down what he remembers of your conversation, and that's impossible when 50 or 100 people are shaking his hand after every service. Writing that letter also gives you the opportunity to pad your pitch with some supporting evidence. In this case, not only the support from bishops, including your own, we hope, but especially referring to the world-class conference that the bishop sponsored in Washington at the Catholic University of America last April. It was thanks to the support from Catholic University's stalwart President John Garvey that this conference came off without a hitch, with the admirable support of the conference offered 3 days of top-notch speakers and presentations, and they're all online. Supporters of Humani Vitae can cite this national conference as their inspiration for activities throughout the country in the diocesan and parish levels. And here's some great news. Our new website devoted to Humani Vitae is now online. It's a treasure trove of information for your parish group. Here's how to find it. Go to your website browser and type in humanevitae.org, no spaces, and remember, the dot is a period. There you will find a treasure trove of information for your parish group. Just go to humanevitae.org to find not only the masterful history of contraception by Dr. Gonzalo Herranz in four languages, and by the way, that's the history of the promotion of contraception against church teaching and natural law for over 100 years. But it also includes the latest news and links in a wide array of resources. We'll be updating the site continually with new reports, materials, and insights from all over the world. In no time, it will be your go-to site for Humanae Vitae news. Remember, just go to humanevitaeproject.org and enjoy. And please don't forget to support PRI so that we can keep this project worldwide in four languages going until everyone knows the truth about Humanae Vitae. PRI President Stephen Mosier condemns the Vatican for its betrayal in the secret agreement it has made with Communist China. Stephen Mosier writes, "As someone who over the years has helped underground Catholics in China build churches and open orphanages, I believe that the provisional agreement between the Vatican and Communist China is a betrayal of the Catholic Church in that country. Actually, I see it as a betrayal on several levels. It betrays the authority of the papacy by giving the Chinese Communist Party the right to name bishops. It betrays the underground church in China, a church which not only has survived decades of persecution at the hands of the authorities, but is now once again under siege. And I would argue because it is a secret agreement, it betrays the truth by allowing both sides to misrepresent it." Whose purposes are being served by signing a secret agreement? Scripture tells us that darkness always hates the light. A secret agreement keeps Catholics in China and around the world in the dark about whatever compromises the Vatican has made. Even worse, it allows the communist authorities to misrepresent the agreement to the Chinese faithful in whichever way they choose. They will surely use the borrowed authority of the Vatican to undermine the faith of the believers in China in their own church. Cardinal Parolin, the Vatican Secretary of State, told me, Stephen Mosier writes, in May, that the signing of an agreement with a Chinese party state would give Rome so-called leverage over the communist authorities that it could use to help Catholics in China. But how much leverage does an agreement give you that is not only secret but entirely provisional? The answer? Of course, none. If the Vatican is relying on the trustworthiness of Chinese communist officials, it will surely be disappointed. Beijing has signed many agreements over the years, agreements whose terms are publicly known, only to violate them before the ink is dry on the paper. Cardinal Parolin insisted to me that since we will be signing an agreement with Xi Jinping himself, will they not abide by it? The short answer is no. The Chinese party state has signed many agreements over the years, many of which it simply later ignored, like the Sino-British agreement over Hong Kong. Others, like the World Trade Organization covenants, it merely pretends to honor. Does the Vatican not know that the same officials they are naively trusting to keep an agreement are currently engaged in a widespread crackdown on all forms of religious expression in China? Cardinal Parolin certainly knows, since I read him the new regulations restricting religious activities during the course of our meeting. These new regulations, announced on February 1st of this year, have led a wave of persecution, which churches are being torn down and Bibles are being burned. These new regulations, announced on February 1st of this year, have led to a wave of persecution in which churches are being torn down and Bibles are being burned. Will the communist authorities cease and desist simply because they have signed an agreement with the Vatican? It seems unlikely. As I write, Moser goes on, in Bully of Asia, the head of the Chinese Communist Party, Xi Jinping, is modeling himself on the late Chairman Mao, one of the great mass murderers of human history. Like Mao, Xi is carrying out a cultural revolution in China to eliminate all religions, and he has made it clear that he simply will not tolerate foreign interference in internal Chinese matters. What this means is that, whatever the precise terms of the secret agreement, it will not put the Vatican in a position to aid the Chinese Catholic Church, much less direct its activities. The agreement will instead benefit the Chinese party state, which will use it to assert its control over the underground church in China. It will tell the faithful that the Pope himself has recognized the communist-run Chinese Patriotic Catholic Association and that each and every one of China's 12 million Catholics must worship only in its churches. It will intensify its attack on the underground church, using the borrowed authority of the Vatican itself as an ideological assault weapon. I will say that had the agreement been negotiated by prelates like Cardinal Zen, men who are profoundly and personally aware of the nature of the officially atheistic one-party dictatorship that rules China, we could have confidence in it. But I have no confidence in an agreement that was negotiated by clerics who have zero understanding of China's recent history of brutally suppressing religion. These include clerics like the now disgraced McCarrick, who has made no fewer than 8 trips to China in recent years, the last few at the specific request of Pope Francis, in pursuit of just such an agreement. The Communist Party has long been determined to force underground Chinese Catholics out of the catacombs so they can be brought under strict party control. Why anyone in the Vatican, including Cardinal Parolin, would think it's a good idea to lend the name of the Pope to this effort in this way is beyond me. We must pray for the suffering church in China. This has been the PRI Review from the Population Research Institute at pop.org. Thanks for listening.